session number 17825, Reel 1.
Mr. McGovern, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
In St. Helens, Lancashire.
Which year was this?
The 13th of June, 1924.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in St. Helens?
All of my youth was spent in and around St. Helens.
Which school did you go to in St. Helens?
Initially to the Holy Cross Primary School, then latterly to the Cowley High School.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
I was 15 when I finished my schooling.
So this was about the time
1939,
war broke out.
Just about the time war broke out, yes, that's true.
Did you get a job on leaving school?
Not initially, but after perhaps 6 months. When I started work then with a company who were manufacturing the plastic film, what did we call it then, cellophane. After a short time working there, I joined the local glassworks, Pilkington Brothers, as a process worker, until joining the Royal Air Force in December 1942.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Indeed I did, and remember quite clearly seeing the pictures in the newspapers of him waving his sheet of paper as he descended from the aircraft, "Peace in our time."
But when he actually declared war a year later on the famous radio broadcast, did you hear that?
Yes, I can remember hearing that on the radio. I remember standing as a boy then in the centre of town and looking at the town hall clock, thinking, well, I'm watching the course of history. And of course, as 11 a.m. came and went, it then became quite apparent that we were at war with Germany.
Did you feel any sense of dismay or excitement about the war declaration?
Well, I think because our lives were fairly mundane, I felt a source of exhilaration from what I can recall. And, a thought that, well, this is where a little excitement enters our lives. Not being aware at that age or time of the terrible consequences that could ensue from a declaration of war.
Were you in any early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
Not close to, but we did have the very heavy raids on Liverpool, and the stray bomber came over St. Helens, caused a huge fire in Pilkington's timber yard. Incendiaries were dropped in Pilkington's timber yard, huge blaze, and the odd few bombs were scattered about the town. I think there were one or two people killed, possibly half a dozen houses demolished, and not too far from my home, a little chapel was set on fire by what must have been a fairly heavy incendiary bomb. But my main recollection of that time was of the heavy raids on Liverpool, searchlights operating in and around Liverpool, and of course of the anti-aircraft fire.
Which chapel was it that was set on fire?
I can't remember the name of it, but it was, I think it was not a Methodist chapel, but one of the nonconformist religions. Quite a small one.
Do you remember the name of the street?
Oh, yes, I do. It was in Corporation Street, St. Helens, and it was next to what used to be the old Central Station in St. Helens.
Near where we've just met?
Well, that was That's been renamed. That used to be known in the old days as the Shore Street Station, for obvious reasons, because the station, you know, that you spoke about earlier on the telephone as the St Helens Junction Station was not one that was used greatly by the people of the town centre. That was usually on a different line, I believe, on a different railway line, which initially came from the central station in Corporation Street was a terminus for a line that went through to Wigan and on through, I believe, to Preston or perhaps Southport.
What was public morale like during the bombing, as far as you remember?
Well, since we were not sort of in the midst of conflict here in St Helens, as I've already said, we were mainly on the periphery of it. The main focus of attention for the German Air Force at that time were the docks and the centre of Liverpool, Birkenhead, Bootle. But people at that time, my memory is that people were very busy. Most of the men, of course, of up to the age of possibly 40, although I'm only hazarding a guess there, they were away on war service or directed into industry. Those who were unfit for military service were often working very long hours to keep the factories moving. A lot of people used to use the station to which I referred, the Central Street Station. That was used as the main transport route to the Risley Armament Factory. And an awful lot of the ladies particularly worked at Risley, manufacturing bombs, shells, what have we, other materials of war.
So did the war have much effect on you personally before 1942?
Not a great deal, because the effects were often slow. There was nothing dramatic. I think about the most dramatic effect was the issue of civilian gas masks, which sort of was a signal point that here was something that really had to be taken note of, and which is quite a significant thing, caused local excitement, and that, you know, there was a potential hazard coming our way. As a young man, excitement was the name of the game for me. My life had been so mundane up to then, I think I yearned for excitement. But apart from what went on locally, visiting the local hop, that was about the highlights of our careers then. Oh, and of course I was a member of the Air Training Corps, and at the same time I was also a messenger boy with the what was then the Auxiliary Fire Service, and that used to occupy most of my non-working hours. And I can distinctly remember, as a member of the Auxiliary Fire Service, my duties were that should there at any time be a disruption of communication between the central headquarters, located in the town hall, then it would be my job, along with two or three other young men, on their push bikes, equipped with their steel helmets, to carry whatever communications were required to other fire stations not too far apart. And I can distinctly remember in the heavy bombing, I suppose it would be 1941, but I don't know how accurate my memory is, but I think it would be in the winter of 1941 when the Liverpool docks were taking such a heavy hammering from the Luftwaffe, and huge fires were started down in Liverpool. They started to sort of move fire engines and crews from the St Helens area forward into Liverpool to help cope with the problems there. And at the same time, we're bringing in fire crews from places such as Bolton, Lee, Wigan, to sort of come to support then the requirements that might be required locally. And I can remember being given the job one time. I was asked, did I know where the fire headquarters were in the centre of Liverpool? And I said, yes, I did. So they said, right, the chief says, put your bike on this engine and take these people down to Liverpool. Well, we found our way through Prescott and on down to the outskirts of Liverpool. I got to the top of Scotland Road and I said, I'm not going any further into that little lot. Lift my bike down. I pointed the direction. I said, that's the way down there. And I left them to it. Got on my push bike and returned home.
What was that little lot like?
Quite a lot of fires, bright red skies, a lot of falling anti-aircraft shell shrapnel, and generally, I think deserted streets is what I can recall.
Was it a frightening sight?
It was to me as a young man, because I was, 16 then?
But you never actually attended any fires in Liverpool?
No, I did not. No, I didn't go down into the centre of Liverpool. Nor do I think that I was really expected to. I felt that I'd done my duty in getting the firemen to within striking distance of the destination.
Did you ever get any reports from your colleagues about attending fires in Liverpool?
Not that I can recall, no.
You said that there was all that excitement at the issue of gas masks. What did the excitement consist of?
Well, simply that it was a portend of things to come. We weren't sure quite what to expect. You will recall, perhaps, that at this time we had brown adhesive tape strips over the windows in order to ensure a minimum of flying glass should we be subject to attack. And this was signs of a further development or potential development in the escalation of the civilian life with regard to the war. But as I've already said, things didn't come with a tremendous thump. Things happened fairly gradually, one thing developing after another. By that I mean, initially there was no rationing, then rationing was introduced. People were called up to serve in the forces, initially of course, the territorial people, the people who were part-time soldiers and so on. Then, of course, came conscription after a while. People were then, following on the heels of conscription, people were then starting to be directed to work which they normally would not have done. For example, shop girls being directed into munitions, this kind of thing. No street lamps, streets in total darkness. The advent in the summer, I recall so particularly during the Battle of Britain days, when we had the double British summertime and it was light almost until midnight. This seemed a totally different world to that in which we had grown up as children. And all of these things tended to add a little spice to life, I think.
What was the method of issuing the gas masks?
I believe they were issued via the local schools, if my memory serves me right. And of course we were issued with identity cards as well. Although most of this was done by my parents at that time, they would go and do whatever was required to fill in the appropriate paperwork, and then they would come home with the identification cards.
What was your attitude towards the German enemy at this time?
Well, obviously, my attitude was coloured by the propaganda that we were receiving via the media. Beastly Germans, sinking all our ships, making life difficult for us. This business of Germans being accused of sticking their bayonets into infants. Generally, the government of the day, I suppose quite rightly under the circumstances, were creating an atmosphere where one would hate the enemy, as they were then deemed to be, and prosecute the war to the full. And of course a lot of this was justifying the development of our bombing of German cities. Initially, of course, we had been restricted to purely military offensives, shipping and the like. And I don't think, even at that time, that we were attacking civilian ships, although I stand to be corrected. But certainly most of the bombing I can remember was on places such as Bremerhaven, Kiel, and the German Baltic ports.
What did you learn in the ATC?
I can remember being taught in the ATC specifically to the basic principles of a radio, teaching me all about Ohm's law and the use of the Wheatstone Bridge and the various communication systems that were available. A little bit on weapons, but not much. Usually using very decrepit, I think, 1914-18 war equipment.
Why had you wanted to go into the RAF?
I'd wanted to be in the RAF since I started reading the Biggles books as a boy, so that I'd always wanted to fly. And when I was talking with my friends, the one whose pictures I've seen there, we couldn't wait to get down and join up. And I can remember going down as soon as I was 18, down to Renshaw Street in Liverpool. And of course, that would be early in 42, June 42, that must have been. And the recruiting officer sort of looked at us and took our age, gave us a medical, and said, all right, well, we'll send for you later on. And I seem to recall that we did the full range of tests at that time, the medical test, an intelligence test, a written paper, interviewed by a board of rather senior officers, as it seemed to me at the time, although I can't remember what their ranks were, and then asked if I would like to be trained as an air gunner. And of course my answer was, oh yes please, anything to get airborne. Right, they said, we'll send for you when you're old enough, we can't take you yet. So then, virtually within days of being 18 and a half, which was in December 1942, I received my request to report to Padgate Recruiting Centre. When I got to Padgate then, just prior to Christmas, they said, "We don't know what the hell they've sent you here for now. Here's a fortnight's leave, push off home," or words to that effect, "and we'll see you in the new year." So then it was early in 1943 when service actually started. From then on, it was simply a question of injections, medical again, equipping you with your RAF uniform. And I think all in all, I was at Padgate about 2 weeks. And then it was down to St John's Wood Aircrew Reception Centre, where you were given marched about the various parts of London, including Lord's Cricket Ground, to have your photographs taken, and issued with your 1250, I think that was the name of it, the 1250 identification card. Dental examination, I seem to recall a brutal dentist down there at St John's Wood ripping out some of the teeth I was reluctant to part with. And then being marched down to, I shall never forget it, the Wigmore Hall, where we were given some gruesome lectures on the results of going with certain types of women, and the consequences that could ensue were shown by huge portraits. I think there were projections onto a large screen down there. Oh, the most frightening situation that certainly would dissuade you from going with any of the loose ladies in London. I can't remember how long we were at St John's Wood, not very long. And then it was initial training wing at Bridlington. Now that must have been early March 1943. And the thing I remember about that most distinctly is being invited to partake of PE on Bridlington Beach in shorts and a vest on a March morning with a brisk wind, whipping that sand up, peppering your legs and the rest of your body. And if you haven't had that experience, you haven't lived. Then, of course, at ITW, I can quite distinctly recall being going through Morse code, use of the Morse key, the Aldis lamp, basic navigation, triangle of velocities, a little bit of marching. I fell slightly behind the course there. Oh, but that's right, I can remember we did some, a little bit of so-called square bashing in those days, the rudiments of military discipline. But I fell behind. I think I must have got influenza or something similar, because I was taken to an RAF hospital at, I believe it was Robin Hood's Bay, so I was told. And I suppose I fell behind my course rather slightly. However, I did complete the course. And from then on, we were shipped out to Number 9O, that was observers, an advanced flying unit at Penrose. But one of the items I can remember from Bridlington was being put on guard duty there, me weighing a little more than 9 stone, with a policeman's truncheon, and I was all supposed to keep off all intruders to their ministry premises. I thought, how ludicrous this is. However, at Penrose, this is when things really got started then, through the elements of air gunnery, learning to strip down the Lewis gun and the Browning 303 machine gun. Further, I can't recall whether we did any further Morse tests, on, but I think we were expected to be proficient by the time we got there. I think we did about 12 on the Aldis lamp and 18 on words per minute on the key. But there it was concentrated on classroom training, as I've already said, the principles of air gunnery and bullet trail and gravity drop and how to take evasive manoeuvres, what you should be doing with attacks from certain distances, range finding of your enemy aircraft, aircraft recognition, so that you could, you probably are aware of the reflector sight, which subtended at a given angle. Therefore, by use of the reflector sight and a knowledge of the wingspan of the aircraft coming towards you, you could assess its range and thereby make the appropriate deflection shooting. However, cine camera gun, and we were flying then Blenheim 4s and Ansons. I think all of them in rather a decrepit state. My experience of the Blenheim 4 was the one where it had the Bristol turret, and the gunner's seat was arranged on the end of an arm, which, as you elevated the guns, it lowered the seat to maintain your attitude with the gun sight. But on depressing the guns on the beam, the seat then came up. And if you're anything like a tall fellow, it must have crushed you up against the roof of the turret, because there was very little give. Oh dear, what an episode that was. And my abiding experience there and memory of the Blenheim 4 aircraft, whether it was those particular aircraft that, as I've already said, were rather decrepit, but on final approach, on landing, the smell of petrol fumes in the fuselage was so powerful as to make you feel sick. I don't know how the pilots ever put up with it. But you'll see from my logbook that most of the pilots were Czechs and Polish people, half of whom you couldn't understand anyway on the intercom. But how they tolerated those conditions, I don't know. Perhaps they were used to it, but it was the nearest one could get to being airsick, purely and simply as a result of the fumes in the fuselage. But happily, of course, it was at the end of your exercise, so but, it didn't much matter.
What was your attitude by now towards actually going into action in aeroplanes?
Well, I think we, as a general attitude, was we were looking forward to it, because the instructors then at that stage were all ex-operational aircrew. And they would tell you, despite the fact that you were being chased about the station and strict timetable, strict code of dress, that once you got to your squadron, life would be so much easier, so much more comfortable. And of course, that in itself